faintly tinged with alarm. "She hasn't set a sheriff on me, has she?"
"Set a sheriff on you? Who?" I said, joining in the chorus of bafflement. I hung the kettle back on its tripod and reached for the tin of tea leaves. "Whatever have you been doing, Roger?"
A faint flush showed over his high cheekbones, but before he could answer, Brianna snorted briefly.
"Telling Aunt Jocasta where she gets off?"
She glanced at Roger, and her eyes narrowed into triangles of mildly malicious amusement as she envisioned the scene.
"Boy, I wish I'd been there."
"Whatever did you say to her, Roger?" I inquired, interested. The flush deepened, and he looked away.
"I don't wish to repeat it," he said shortly. "It wasn't the sort of thing one ought to say to a woman, let alone an elderly one, and particularly one about to be related to me by marriage. I was just asking Bree whether I maybe ought to go and apologise to Mrs. Cameron before the wedding."
"No," Bree said promptly. "The nerve of her! You had every right to say what you did."
"Well, I don't regret the substance of my remarks," Roger said to her with a wry hint of a smile. "Only the form." "See," he said, turning to me, "I'm only thinking that perhaps I should apologise to keep it from being awkward tonight. I don't want Bree's wedding to be spoiled."
"Bree's wedding? You think I'm getting married by myself?" she asked, lowering thick red brows at him.
"Oh, well, no," he admitted, smiling a little.
He touched her cheek gently.
"I'll stand up next to you, to be sure. But so long as we end up married, I'm not so much bothered about the ceremony. You'll want it to be nice, though, won't you? Put a damper on the occasion and your auntie crowns me with a stick of firewood before I can say, I will."
I was by now consumed with curiosity to know just what he had said to Jocasta, but thought I'd better address the more immediate issue, which was that at the moment of going to press, it appeared that there might be no wedding to be spoiled. "And so Jamie's out looking for Father Kenneth now," I finished. "Massali didn't recognise the sheriff who took him, though, which makes it difficult." Roger's dark brows lifted, then drew together in concern.
"I wonder,"
he said, and turned to me.
"Do you know, I think perhaps I saw him just a few moments ago."
"Father Kenneth?" I asked, knife suspended over the fruitcake.
"No, the sheriff."
"What? Where?"
Bree half turned on one heel, glaring round. Her hand curled up into a fist, and I thought it rather fortunate that the sheriff wasn't in sight. Having Brianna arrested for assault really would have a dampening effect on the wedding.
"He went that way."
Roger gestured downhill toward the creek and Lieutenant Hayes's tent. As he did so, we heard the sound of footsteps squelching through mud, and a moment later Jamie appeared, looking tired, worried, and highly annoyed. Obviously, he hadn't yet found the priest.
"Da!" Bree greeted him with excitement. "Roger thinks he's seen the sheriff who took Father Kenneth."
"Why?"
Jamie at once perked up.
"Where?"
His left hand curled up in anticipation, and I couldn't help smiling.
"What's funny?"
he demanded, seeing it.
"Nothing,"
I assured him.
"Here, have some fruitcake."
I handed him a slice, which he promptly crammed into his mouth, returning his attention to Roger.
"Where?"
he demanded, indistinctly.
"I don't know that it was the man you're looking for," Roger told him. "He was a raggedy wee man. But he had got a prisoner. He was taking one of the fellows from Drunkard's Creek off in handcuffs. McLennan, I think."
Jamie choked and coughed, spewing small bits of masticated fruitcake into the fire.
"He arrested Mr. McLennan? And you let him?"
Bree was staring at Roger in consternation. Neither she nor Roger had been present when Abel McLennan had told his story over breakfast, but both of them knew him.
"I couldn't have very well prevent him," Roger pointed out mildly.
"I did call out to McLennan to ask if he wanted help. I thought I'd fetch your Da or Farquhar Campbell if he did. But he just looked through me, as though I might have been a ghost. And then, when I called again, he gave me an odd sort of smile and shook his head. I didn't think I ought to go and beat up a sheriff just on general principle, but if you...
Not a sheriff, Jamie said hoarsely.
His eyes were watering, and he paused to cough explosively again.
A thief-taker, I told Roger. Something like a bounty hunter, I gather.
The tea wasn't nearly brewed yet. I found a half-full stone bottle of ale and handed that to Jamie.
Where will he be taking Abel? I asked. You said Hayes didn't want prisoners.
Jamie shook his head, swallowed, and lowered the bottle, breathing a little easier.
He doesn't. No, Mr. Bobble. It must be him, aye. We'll take Abel to the nearest magistrate. And if wee Roger saw him just the now...
He turned, thinking, brows furrowed as he surveyed the mountainside around us.
It'll be Fakert, most likely, he concluded, his shoulders relaxing a little. I ken four justices of the peace and three magistrates here at the gathering. And of the lot, Campbell's the only one camped on this side.
Oh, that's good.
I sighed in relief. Fakert Campbell was a fair man,
a stickler for the law, but not without compassion. And, more importantly, perhaps, a very old friend of Jocasta Cameron. Aye, we'll ask my aunt to have a word. Perhaps we'd best do it before the weddings.
He turned to Roger.
Will you go, Mackenzie? I must be finding Father Kenneth, if there are to be any weddings.
Roger looked as though he too had just choked on a bit of fruitcake. Well, he said awkwardly, perhaps I'm no the best man to be saying anything to Mrs. Cameron just now.
Jamie was staring at him in mingled interest and exasperation.
Why not?
Blushing fiercely, Roger recounted the substance of his conversation with Jocasta, lowering his voice nearly to the point of inaudibility at the conclusion.
We heard it clearly enough, nonetheless.
Jamie looked at me. His mouth twitched. Then his shoulders began to shake. I felt the laughter bubble up under my ribs, but it was nothing to Jamie's hilarity. He laughed almost silently, but so hard that tears came to his eyes.
"Oh, Christ!" he gasped at last.
He clutched his side, still wheezing faintly.
"God! I've sprung a rib, I think."
He reached out and took one of the half-dried, clean clouts from a bush, carelessly wiping his face with it.
"All right," he said, recovering himself somewhat. "Go and see Fakert, then. If Abel's there, tell Campbell I'll stand surety for him. Bring him back with you."
He made a brief shooing gesture, and Roger, puce with mortification but stiff with dignity, departed at once. Bree followed him, casting a glance of reproof at her father, which merely had the effect of causing him to wheeze some more. I drowned my own mirth with a gulp of steaming tea, blissfully fragrant. I offered the cup to Jamie, but he waved it away, content with the rest of the ale.
"My aunt," he observed, lowering the bottle at last, "kens very well indeed what money will buy and what it will not."
"And she's just bought herself, and everyone else in the county, a good opinion of poor Roger, hasn't she?" I replied rather dryly.
Jocasta Cameron was a Mackenzie of Leoch, a family Jamie had once described as charming as the larks in the field and sly as foxes with it. Whether Jocasta had truly had any doubt herself of Roger's motives in marrying Bree, or merely thought to forestall idle gossip along the Cape Fear, her methods had been undeniably successful. She was probably up in her tent chortling over her cleverness, looking forward to spreading the story of her offer and Roger's response to it.
"Poor Roger,"
Jamie agreed, his mouth still twitching.
"Poor, but virtuous."
He tipped up the bottle of ale, drained it, and set it down with a brief sigh of satisfaction.
"Though, come to that," he added, glancing at me, "she's bought the lad something of value as well, hasn't she?"
"My son," I quoted softly, nodding. "Do you think he realized it himself before he said it? That he really feels Jemmy as his son?"
Jamie made an indeterminate movement with his shoulders, not quite a shrug.
I can't say. It's as well he should have that fixed in his mind, though, before the next bairn comes along. One he kens for sure is his.
I thought of my conversation that morning with Brianna, but decided it was wiser to say nothing, at least for now. It was, after all, a matter between Roger and Bree. I only nodded and turned to tidy away the tea things. I felt a small glow in the pit of my stomach that was only partly the result of the tea. Roger had sworn an oath to take Jemmy as his own, no matter what the little boy's true paternity might be. He was an honourable man, Roger, and he meant it. But the speech of the heart is louder than the words of any oath spoken by lips alone. When I had gone back, pregnant, through the stones, Frank had sworn to me that he would keep me as his wife, would treat the coming child as his own, would love me as he had before. All three of those vows, his lips and mine, had done his best to keep. But his heart, in the end, had sworn only one. From the moment that he took Brianna in his arms, she was his daughter. But what if there had been another child? I wondered suddenly. It had never been a possibility. But if it had? Slowly I wiped the teapot dry and wrapped it in a towel, contemplating the vision of that mythical child, the one Frank and I might have had, but never did, and never would. I laid the wrapped teapot in the chest, gently, as though it were a sleeping baby. When I turned back, Jamie was still standing there, looking at me with a rather odd expression, tender, yet somehow rueful.
"Did I ever think to thank you, Sassenach?" he said, his voice a little husky.
"For what?"
I said, puzzled.
He took my hand and drew me gently toward him. He smelled of ale and damp wool, and very faintly of the brandied sweetness of fruitcake.
"For my bairns," he said softly. "For the children that you bore me."
"Oh," I said. I leaned slowly forward and rested my forehead against the solid warmth of his chest. I cupped my hands at the small of his back beneath his coat and sighed. It was my pleasure. "Mr. Fraser! Mr. Fraser!" I lifted my head and turned to see a small boy churning down the steep slope behind us, arms waving to keep his balance, and face bright red with cold and exertion. "Oof!" Jamie got his hands up just in time to catch the boy as he hurtled down the last few feet, quite out of control. He boosted the little boy, whom I recognised as Farquhar Campbell's youngest, up in his arms and smiled at him.
"Aye, Rabbi, what is it? Does your da want me to come for Mr. McLennan?"
Rabbi shook his head, shaggy hair flying like a sheepdog's coat.
"No, sir,"
he panted, gasping for breath. He gulped air, and the small throat swelled like a frog's with the effort to breathe and speak at once.
"No, sir. My da says he's heard where the priest is, and I should show you the way, sir. Will you come?"
Jamie's brows flicked up in momentary surprise. He glanced at me, then smiled at Rabbi and nodded, bending down to set him on his feet.
"Aye, lad, I will. Lead on, then."
"Delicate Farquhar," I said to Jamie under my breath, with a nod at Rabbi, who scampered ahead, looking back over his shoulder now and then to be sure we were managing to keep up with him. No one would notice a small boy among the swarms of children up on the mountain. Everyone would most assuredly have noticed had Farquhar Campbell come himself or sent one of his adult sons. Jamie huffed a little, the mist of his breath a wisp of steam in the gathering chill.
"Well, it's no Farquhar's concern after all, even if he has got a great regard for my aunt. And I expect if he sent the lad to tell me, it means he kens the man who's responsible and doesn't mean to choose up sides with me against him."
He glanced at the setting sun and gave me a rueful look,
I did say I should find Father Kenneth by sunset. But still, I don't think we shall see a wedding tonight, Sassenach.
This ends Disc 6. The Fiery Cross, Disc 7.
Rabbi led us onward and upward, tracing the maze of footpaths and trampled dead grass without hesitation. The sun had finally broken through the clouds. It had sunk deep in the notch of the mountains, but was still high enough to wash the slope with a warm, ruddy light that momentarily belied the chill of the day. People were gathering to their family fires now, hungry for their suppers, and no one spared a glance for us among the bustle. At last, Rabbi came to a stop at the foot of a well-marked path that led up and to the right. I had crisscrossed the mountain's face several times during the week of the gathering, but had never ventured up this high. Who was in custody of Father Kenneth, I wondered, and what did Jamie propose to do about it?
Up there, Rabbi said unnecessarily, pointing to the peak of a large tent just visible through a screen of longleaf pine.
Jamie made a Scottish noise in the back of his throat at sight of the tent.
"Oh," he said softly, "so that's how it is."
"Is it? Never mind how it is. Whose is it?"
I looked dubiously at the tent, which was a large affair of waxed brown canvas, pale in the gloaming. It obviously belonged to someone fairly wealthy, but wasn't one I was familiar with myself.
"Mr. Lilywhite of Hillsborough," Jamie said, and his brows drew down in thought.
He patted Rabbi Campbell on the head and handed him a penny from his sporran.
"Thank you, laddie. Run away to your mum now. It'll be time for your supper."
Rabbi took the coin and vanished without comment, pleased to be finished with his errand.
"Oh, really?"
I cocked a wary eye at the tent. That explained a few things, I supposed, though not everything. Mr. Lilywhite was a magistrate from Hillsborough, though I knew nothing else about him, save what he looked like. I had glimpsed him once or twice during the gathering, a tall, rather drooping man, his figure made distinctive by a bottle-green coat with silver buttons, but had never formally met him. Magistrates were responsible for appointing sheriffs, which explained the connection with the nasty fat man Massali had described, and why Father Kenneth was incarcerated here. But that left open the question of whether it was the sheriff or Mr. Lilywhite who had wanted the priest removed from circulation in the first place. Jamie put a hand on my arm and drew me off the path into the shelter of a small pine tree.
"You dinna ken Mr. Lilywhite, do you, Sassenach?"
"Only by sight. What do you want me to do?" He smiled at me, a hint of mischief in his eyes, despite his worry for Father Kenneth.
"Game for it, are you?"
"Unless you're proposing that I bat Mr. Lilywhite over the head and liberate Father Kenneth by force, I suppose so. That sort of thing is much more your line of country than mine." He laughed at that, and gave the tent what appeared to be a wistful look.
"I should like nothing better," he said,
confirming this impression.
"It wouldn't be difficult in the least," he went on,
eyeing the tan canvas sides of the tent appraisingly as they flexed in the wind.
"Look at the size of it. There cannot be more than two or three men in there, besides the priest. I could wait until the full dark and then take a lad or two and..."
"Yes, but what do you want me to do now?" I interrupted, thinking I had best put a stop to what sounded a distinctly criminal train of thought.
"Ah."
He abandoned his machinations for the moment and squinted at me, appraising my appearance. I'd taken off the blood-stained canvas apron I wore for surgery, had put up my hair neatly with pins, and was reasonably respectable in appearance, if a trifle mud-draggled around the hems.
"You dinna have any of your physician's kit about you?" he asked,
frowning dubiously.
"A bottle of swill? A bitty knife?"
"Bottle of swill, indeed! No, I... Oh, wait a moment. Yes, there are these. Will they do?"
Digging about in the pocket tied at my waist, I had come up with a small ivory box in which I kept my gold-tipped acupuncture needles.
Evidently satisfied, Jamie nodded and pulled out the silver whiskey flask from his sporran.
"Aye, they'll do," he said, handing me the flask. "Take this too, though, for Luke's. Go up to the tent, Sassenach, and tell whoever's guarding the priest that he's ailing."
"The guard?"
"The priest," he said, giving me a look of mild exasperation. "I dare say everyone will ken ye as a healer by now, and know you on sight. Say that Father Kenneth has an illness that you've been treating, and he must have a dose of his medicine at once, lest he sicken and die on them." "I didn't suppose they want that, and they'll not be afraid of you."
"I shouldn't imagine they need be," I agreed, a trifle caustically. "You don't mean me to stab the sheriff through the heart with my needles, then?"
He grinned at the thought, but shook his head.
"Nay, I only want you to learn why they've taken the priest and what they mean to do with him. If I were to go and demand answers myself, it might put them on guard."
Meaning that he hadn't completely abandoned the notion of a later commando raid on Mr. Lillywhite's stronghold should the answers prove unsatisfactory. I glanced at the tent and took a deep breath, settling my shawl about my shoulders.
"All right," I said. "And what are you intending to do while I'm about it?"
"I'm going to go and fetch the bairns," he said.
And with a quick squeeze of my hand for luck, he was off down the trail. I was still wondering exactly what he meant by that cryptic statement, which, bairns, why, as I came within the sight of the open tent flap. But all speculation was driven from my mind by the appearance of a gentleman therein who met Massali's description of "nasty fat man" so exactly that I had no doubt of his identity. He was short and toad-like, with a receding hairline, a belly that strained the buttons of a food-stained linen vest, and small beady eyes that watched me as though assessing my immediate prospects as a food item.
"Good day to you, ma'am," he said.
He viewed me without enthusiasm, no doubt finding me less than toothsome, but inclined his head with formal respect.
"Good day," I replied cheerily, dropping him a brief curtsy. Never hurt to be polite, at least not to start with. "You'll be the sheriff, won't you? I'm afraid I haven't had the pleasure of a formal introduction. I'm Mrs. Fraser, Mrs. James Fraser of Fraser's Ridge."
"David Anstruther, Sheriff of Orange County, your servant, ma'am," he said, bowing again, though with no real evidence of delight.
He didn't show any surprise at hearing Jamie's name, either. Either he simply wasn't familiar with it, rather unlikely, or he had been expecting such an ambassage.
That being so, I saw no point in beating round the bush.
"I understand that you're entertaining Father Donahue," I said pleasantly. "I've come to see him. I'm his physician."
Whatever he'd been expecting, it wasn't that.
His jaw dropped slightly, exposing a severe case of malocclusion, well-advanced gingivitis, and a missing bicuspid.
Before he could close it, a tall gentleman in a bottle-green coat stepped out of the tent behind him.
"Mrs. Fraser," he said, one eyebrow raised. He bowed punctiliously. "You say you wish to speak with a clerical gentleman under arrest?"
"Under arrest?" I affected great surprise at that. "A priest? Why, whatever can he have done?"
The sheriff and the magistrate exchanged glances. Then the magistrate coughed.
"Perhaps you are unaware, madam, that it is illegal for anyone other than the clergy of the established church, the Church of England, that is, to undertake his office within the colony of North Carolina."
I wasn't unaware of that, though I knew that the law was seldom put into effect, there being relatively few of any kind of clergy in the colony to start with, and no one bothering to take any official notice of the itinerant preachers, many of them freelancers in the most basic sense of the word, who did appear from time to time.
"Gracious," I said, affecting shocked surprise to the best of my ability. "No, I had no idea. Goodness me, how very strange." Mr. Lillywhite blinked slightly, which I took as an indication that would just about do in terms of my creating an impression of well-bred shock. I cleared my throat and brought out the silver flask and case of needles.
Well, I do hope any difficulties will soon be resolved. However, I should very much like to see Father Donahue for a moment. As I said, I am his physician. He has an indisposition.
I slid back the cover of the case and delicately displayed the needles, letting them imagine something suitably virulent that requires regular treatment.
Might I see him for a moment to administer his medicine? I shouldn't like to see any mischief result from a lack of care on my part, you know.
I smiled, as charmingly as possible.
The sheriff pulled his neck down into the collar of his coat and looked malevolently amphibious. But Mr. Lillywhite seemed better affected by the smile. He hesitated, looking me over.
"Well, I'm not sure that..." he began,
when the sound of footsteps came squelching up the path behind me.
I turned, half expecting to see Jamie, but instead beheld my recent patient, Mr. Goodwin, one cheek still puffed from my attentions, but sling intact. He was quite as surprised to see me, but greeted me with great cordiality, and a cloud of alcoholic fumes. Evidently Mr. Goodwin had been taking my advice regarding disinfection very seriously.
"Mrs. Fraser, you have not come to minister to my friend Lillywhite, I trust? I expect Mr. Anstruther would benefit from a good purge, though. Clear the bilious humours, eh, David? Ha-ha!"
He clapped the sheriff on the back in affectionate camaraderie, a gesture Anstruther suffered with no more than a small grimace, giving me some idea of Mr. Goodwin's importance in the social scheme of Orange County.
"George, my dear," Mr. Lillywhite greeted him warmly, "you are acquainted with this charming lady, then?" "Oh, indeed, indeed I am, sir," Mr. Goodwin turned a beaming countenance upon me. "Why, Mrs. Fraser did me great service this morning, great service indeed. See here."
He brandished his bound and splinted arm, which I was pleased to see was evidently giving him no pain whatever at the moment, though that probably had more to do with his self-administered anaesthesia than with my workmanship.
"She quite cured my arm with no more than a touch here, a touch there, and drew a broken tooth so clean that I scarce felt a thing. Walk!"
He stuck a finger into the side of his mouth and pulled back his cheek, exposing a tuft of blood-stained wadding protruding from the tooth socket and a neat line of black stitching on the gum.
"Really? I'm most impressed, Mrs. Fraser."
Lillywhite sniffed at the waft of cloves and whiskey from Mr. Goodwin's mouth, looking interested, and I saw the bulge of his cheek as his own tongue tenderly probed a back tooth.
"But what brings you up here, Mrs. Fraser?"
Mr. Goodwin turned the beam of his joviality on me.
"So late in the day. Perhaps you will do me the honour of taking a bit of supper at my fire?"
"Oh, thank you, but I can't really," I said, smiling as charmingly as possible. "I've just come to see another patient, that is..."
"She wants to see the priest,"
Anstruther interrupted. Goodwin blinked at that, taken only slightly aback.
"Priest? There's a priest here?"
"A papist," Mr. Lillywhite amplified, lips curling back a bit from the unclean word.
"It came to my attention that there was a Catholic priest concealed in the assembly who proposed to celebrate a mass during the festivities this evening. I sent Mr. Anstruther to arrest him, of course."
"Father Donahue is a friend of mine," I put in as forcefully as possible, "and he was not concealed. He was invited quite openly as the guest of Mrs. Cameron. He is also a patient and requires treatment. I've come to see that he gets it."
"A friend of yours? Are you Catholic, Mrs. Fraser?"
Mr. Goodwin looked startled. It obviously hadn't occurred to him that he was being treated by a popish dentist, and his hand went to his swollen cheek in bemusement.
"I am," I said, hoping that merely being a Catholic wasn't also against Mr. Lillywhite's conception of the law.
Evidently not. Mr. Goodwin gave Mr. Lillywhite a nudge.
"Oh, come, Randall, let Mrs. Fraser see the fellow. What harm can it do? And if he's truly Jocasta Cameron's guest...
Mr. Lillywhite pursed his lips in thought for a moment, then stood aside, holding back the flap of canvas for me.
"I suppose there can be no harm in your seeing your... friend," he said slowly. "Come in then, madam."
Sundown was at hand, and the tent was dark inside, though one canvas wall still glowed brightly with the sinking sun behind it. I shut my eyes for a moment to accustom them to the change of light, then blinked and looked about to get my bearings. The tent seemed cluttered but relatively luxurious, being equipped with a camp bed and other furniture, the air within scented not only by damp canvas and wool, but with the perfume of Ceylon tea, expensive wine, and almond biscuits. Father Donahue was silhouetted in front of the glowing canvas, sitting on a stool behind a small folding table, on which were arrayed a few sheets of paper, an inkstand, and a quill. They might as well have been thumbscrews, pinchers, and a red-hot poker, judging from his militantly upright attitude, evocative of expectant martyrdom. The clinking of flint and tinderbox came from behind me, and then the faint glow of a light. This swelled, and a black boy, Mr. Lillywhite's servant, I supposed, came forward and silently set a small oil lamp on the table. Now that I got a clear look at the priest, the impression of martyrdom grew more pronounced. He looked like St. Stephen after the first volley of stones, with a bruise on his chin and a first-rate black eye, empurpled from brow ridge to cheekbone, and swollen quite shut. The non-blackened eye widened at sight of me, and he started up with an exclamation of surprise. "Father Kenneth!" I gripped him by the hand and squeezed, smiling broadly for the benefit of whatever audience might be peeking through the flap. "I've brought your medicine. How are you feeling?" I raised my eyebrows and waggled them, indicating that he should play along with the deception. He stared at me in fascination for a moment, then appeared to catch on. He coughed, then, encouraged by my nod, coughed again with more enthusiasm.
"It's very kind of you to think of me, Mrs. Fraser," he wheezed between hacks.
I pulled off the top of the flask and poured out a generous measure of whiskey. "Are you quite all right, Father?" I asked, low-voiced, as I leaned across to hand it to him. "Your face..."
"Oh, it's nothing, Mrs. Fraser, dear. Not at all,"
he assured me, his faint Irish accent coming out under the stress of the occasion. "'Twas only that I made the mistake of resisting when the sheriff arrested me. Not but what, in the shock of it all, I didn't do a small bit of damage to the poor man's bollocks, and him only doing his duty. May God forgive me." Father Kenneth rolled his undamaged eye upward in a pious expression, quite spoiled by the unregenerate grin underneath. Father Kenneth was no more than middle height, and looked older than his years by virtue of the hard wear imposed by long seasons spent in the saddle. Still, he was no more than 35, and lean and tough as whipcord under his worn black coat and frayed linen. I began to understand the sheriff's belligerence.
"Besides," he added, touching his black eye gingerly, "Mr. Lillywhite did tender me a most gracious apology for the hurt."
He nodded toward the table, and I saw that an open bottle of wine and a pewter cup stood among the writing materials, the cup still full, and the level of the wine in the bottle not down by much. The priest picked up the whiskey I had poured and drained it, closing his eyes in dreamy benediction.
"And a finer medicine I hope never to benefit from," he said, opening them. "I do thank you, Mistress Fraser. I'm that restored I might walk on water myself."
He remembered to cough, this one a delicate hack, fist held over his mouth. "What's wrong with the wine?" I asked, with a glance toward the door.
"Oh, not a thing," he said, taking his hand away. "Only I didn't think it quite right to accept the magistrate's refreshments under the circumstances. Call it conscience."
He smiled at me again, but this time with a note of wryness in the grin.
"Why have they arrested you?" I asked, my voice low.
I looked again at the tent's door, but it was empty, and I caught the murmur of voices outside. Evidently, Jamie had been right. They weren't suspicious of me.
"'For saying of the Holy Mass,' he replied, lowering his voice to match mine.
"'Or so they said. "'It's a wicked lie, though. "'I've not said Mass since last Sunday, and that was in Virginia.'
"'He was looking wistfully at the flask. "'I picked it up and poured another generous tot. "'I frowned a bit, thinking, while he drank it more slowly this time. "'Whatever were Mr. Lillywhite and company up to?' They couldn't surely be meaning to bring the priest to trial on the charge of saying Mass. It would be no great matter to find false witnesses to say he had, of course. But what would be the point of it? While Catholicism was certainly not popular in North Carolina, I could see no great purpose in the arrest of a priest who would be leaving in the morning in any case. Father Kenneth came from Baltimore and meant to return there. He had come to the gathering only as a favour to Jocasta Cameron.
"Oh," I said.
And Father Kenneth looked at me inquiringly over the rim of his cup.
"Just a thought," I said, gesturing him to continue. "Do you happen to know whether Mr. Lillywhite is personally acquainted with Mrs. Cameron?"
Jocasta Cameron was a prominent and wealthy woman, and one of strong character, therefore not without enemies.
I couldn't see why Mr. Lillywhite would go out of his way to disoblige her in such a peculiar fashion, even so. But
"'I am acquainted with Mrs. Cameron,' said Mr. Lillywhite, speaking behind me, "'though, alas, I can claim no intimate friendship with the lady.'
I whirled to find him standing just within the tent's entrance, followed by Sheriff Anstruther and Mr. Goodwin, with Jamie bringing up the rear. The latter flicked an eyebrow at me, but otherwise maintained an expression of solemn interest. Mr. Lillywhite bowed to me in acknowledgement.
"'I've just been explaining to your husband, madam, that it is my regard for Mrs. Cameron's interests that led me to attempt to regularise Mr. Donahue's position, so as to allow his continued presence in the colony.'
Mr. Lillywhite nodded coldly at the priest.
"'However, I'm afraid my suggestion was summarily rejected.
Father Kenneth put down his cup and straightened up, his working eye bright in the lamplight.
They wish me to sign an oath, sir, he said to Jamie, with a gesture at the paper and quill on the table before him, to the effect that I do not subscribe to a belief in transubstantiation.
Do they indeed?
Jamie's voice betrayed no more than polite interest. But I understood at once what the priest had meant by his remark regarding conscience.
"'Well, he can't do that, can he?' I said, looking round the circle of men. "'Catholics, I mean we,' I spoke with some emphasis, looking at Mr. Goodwin, "'do believe in transubstantiation, don't we?'
I asked, turning to the priest, who smiled slightly in response and nodded. Mr. Goodwin looked unhappy but resigned, his alcoholic joviality substantially reduced by the social awkwardness.
"'I'm sorry, Mrs. Fraser, but that is the law. The only circumstance under which a clergyman who does not belong to the established church may remain in the colony, legally, is upon the signing of such an oath. Many do sign it. You know the Reverend Ermston, Methodist circuit rider? He has signed the oath, as has Mr. Culver, the New Light minister who lives near Wadesboro.
The sheriff looked smug. Repressing an urge to stamp on his foot, I turned to Mr. Lillywhite.
Well, but Father Donahue can't sign it. So what do you propose to do with him? Throw the poor man in jail?
You can't do that. He's ill. On cue, Father Kenneth coughed obligingly.
Mr. Lillywhite eyed me dubiously, but chose instead to address Jamie.
I could by rights imprison the man, but out of regard for you, Mr. Fraser, and for your aunt, I shall not do so. He must, however, leave the colony tomorrow. I shall have him escorted into Virginia, where he will be released from custody. You may rest assured that all care will be taken to assure his welfare on the journey.
He turned a cold grey eye on the sheriff, who straightened up and tried to look reliable, with indifferent results.
I see.
Jamie spoke lightly, looking from one man to another, his eyes coming to rest on the sheriff. "I trust that is true, sir. For if I should hear of any harm coming to the good father, I should be most distressed."
The sheriff met his gaze, stone-faced, and held it until Mr. Lillywhite cleared his throat, frowning at the sheriff.
"You have my word upon it, Mr. Fraser."
Jamie turned to him, bowing slightly.
"I could ask no more, sir. And yet, if I may presume, might the father not spend tonight in comfort among his friends, that they might take their leave of him, and that my wife might attend his injuries? I would stand surety for his safe delivery into your hand come morning."
Mr. Lillywhite pursed his lips and affected to consider the suggestion. But the magistrate was a poor actor. I realised with some interest that he had foreseen this request and had his mind made up already to deny it.
"No, sir," he said, trying for a tone of reluctance. "I regret that I cannot grant your request. Though, if the priest wishes to write letters to various of his acquaintance..."
He gestured at the sheaf of papers.
"I will undertake to see them promptly delivered."
Jamie cleared his own throat and threw himself up a bit.
"Well, then," he said, "I wonder whether I might make so bold as to ask..."
He paused, seeming slightly embarrassed.
"Yes, sir."
Lillywhite looked at him curiously.
"I wonder whether the good father might be allowed to hear my confession."
Jamie's eyes were fixed on the tent pole, sedulously avoiding mine.
"Your confession?"
Lillywhite looked astonished at this, though the sheriff made a noise that might charitably be called a snigger.
"Got something pressing on your conscience?" Anstruther asked rudely. "Or perhaps you have some premonition of impending death, eh?"
He gave an evil smile at this, and Mr. Goodwin, looking shocked, rumbled a protest at him. Jamie ignored both of them, focusing his regard on Mr. Lillywhite.
"Yes, sir. It has been some time since I last had the opportunity of being shriven, you see. And it may well be some time before such a chance occurs again. As it is..."
At this point, he caught my eye and made a slight but emphatic motion with his head toward the tent flap.
"If you will excuse us for a moment, gentlemen."
Not waiting for a response, he seized me by the elbow and propelled me swiftly outside.
"Brianna and Massali are up the path with the weans," he hissed in my ear, the moment we were clear of the tent. "Make sure Lillywhite and yon bastard of a sheriff are well away, then fetch them in."
Leaving me standing on the path, astonished, he ducked back into the tent.
"Your pardon, gentlemen," I heard him say. "I thought perhaps there are some things a man shouldn't quite like to be saying before his wife. You understand?"
There were male murmurs of understanding, and I caught the word confession repeated in dubious tones by Mr. Lillywhite. Jamie lowered his voice to a confidential rumble in response, interrupted by a rather loud, "You what?" from the sheriff, and a peremptory shushing by Mr. Goodwin. There was a bit of confused conversation, then a shuffle of movement, and I barely made it off the path and into the shelter of the pines before the tent flap lifted, and the three Protestants emerged from the tent. The day had all but faded now, leaving burning embers of sunlit cloud in the sky. But close as they were, there was enough light for me to see the air of vague embarrassment that beset them. They moved a few steps down the path, stopping no more than a few feet from my own hiding place. They stood in a cluster to confer, looking back at the tent, from which I could now hear Father Kenneth's voice raised in a formal Latin blessing. The lamp in the tent went out, and the forms of Jamie and the priest, dim shadows on the canvas, disappeared into a confessional darkness. Anstruther's bulk sidled closer to Mr. Goodwin.
"What in fuck's name is transubstantiation?" he muttered.
I saw Mr. Goodwin's shoulders straighten as he drew himself up, then hunched toward his ears in a shrug.
"In all honesty, sir, I'm not positive of the meaning of the term," he said, rather primly, "though I perceive it to be some form of pernicious papist doctrine.
Perhaps Mr. Lillywhite could supply you with a more complete definition. Randall?
Indeed, the magistrate said. It is the notion that by the priest speaking particular words in the course of offering his mass, bread and wine are transformed into the very substance of our Saviour's body and blood.
What?
Anstruther sounded confused.
How can anyone do that?
Change bread and wine into flesh and blood? Mr. Goodwin sounded quite taken aback.
But that is witchcraft, surely.
Well, it would be, if it happened, Mr. Lillywhite said, sounding a bit more human. The church very rightly holds that it does not.
Are we sure of that?
Anstruther sounded suspicious.
Have you seen them do it?
Have I attended a Catholic mass?
Assuredly not.
Lillywhite's tall form drew up, austere in the gathering dusk.
What do you take me for, sir? Now, Randall, I'm sure the sheriff means no offence.
Goodwin put a placatory hand on his friend's arm. His office deals with more earthly matters, after all.
No, no, no offence meant, sir, none at all,
Anstruther said hurriedly. I was meaning more like, has anybody seen this kind of goings-on, so as to be decent witnesses for the prosecution of it, I mean? Mr. Lillywhite appeared still to be somewhat offended. His voice was cold in reply.
It is scarcely necessary to have witnesses to the heresy, Sheriff, as the priests themselves willingly admit to it. No, no, of course not.
The Sheriff's squat form seemed to flatten obsequiously.
But if I'm right, sir, papists do, partake of this trans-what-not, aye?
Yes, so I'm told.
Well, then, that's friggin' cannibalism, isn't it?
Anstruther's bulk popped up again, enthused.
I know that's against the law. Why not let this bugger do his bit of hocus-pocus and we'll arrest the old boiling lot of them, eh? Get shut of any number of the bastards at one blow, I dare say.
Mr. Goodwin emitted a low moan. He appeared to be massaging his face, no doubt to ease a recurrent ache from his tooth. Mr. Lillywhite exhaled strongly through his nose.
No, he said evenly. I'm afraid not, Sheriff. My instructions are that the priest is not to be allowed to perform any ceremonial and shall be prevented from receiving visitors.
Oh, aye. What's he doing now, then?
Anstruther demanded, gesturing toward the darkened tent where Jamie's voice had begun to speak, hesitant and barely audible. I thought perhaps he was speaking in Latin.
That is quite different, Lillywhite said testily. Mr. Fraser is a gentleman. And the prohibition against visitors is to ensure that the priest shall perform no secret marriages.
Hardly a concern at present.
Bless me, Father, for I have sinned.
Jamie's voice spoke in English, suddenly louder, and Mr. Lillywhite started. Father Kenneth murmured interrogatively.
I've been guilty of the sins of lust and impurity, both in thought and in my flesh,
Jamie announced, with what I thought rather more volume than was quite discreet.
Oh, to be sure,
said Father Kenneth, suddenly louder too. He sounded interested.
Now, these sins of impurity, what form precisely did they take, my son, and upon how many occasions? Aye, well, I've looked upon women with lust to be starting with. How many occasions? Ooh, make it 100 at least. Been a time since I was last to confession. Do you need to know which women, Father, or only what it was I thought of doing to them?
Mr. Lillywhite stiffened markedly.
I think we'll not have time for the lot, Jamie dear, said the priest.
But if you were to tell me about one or two of these occasions, just so as I could be forming a notion as to the severity of the offence. Och, aye. Well, the worst was likely the time with a butter churn.
Butter churn? The sort with the handle poking up.
Father Kenneth's tone encompassed a sad compassion for the lewd possibilities suggested by this.
Oh, no, Father. That was a barrel churn. The sort that lies on its side, aye, with a wee handle to turn it. Well, it's only that she was working the churn with great vigour, and the laces of her bodice undone,
so that her breasts wobbled to and fro, and the cloth clinging to her with the sweat of her work. Now the churn was just the right height, and curved eye, so as to make me think of bending her across it and lifting her skirts, and... My mouth opened involuntarily in shock. That was my bodice he was describing, my breasts and my butter churn, to say nothing of my skirts. I remembered that particular occasion quite vividly, and if it had started with an impure thought, it certainly hadn't stopped there. A rustling and murmuring drew my attention back to the men on the path. Mr. Lillywhite had grasped the sheriff, still leaning avidly toward the tent, ears flapping, by the arm, and was hissing at him as he forced him hastily down the path. Mr. Goodwin followed, though with an air of reluctance. The noise of their departure had unfortunately drowned out the rest of Jamie's description of that particular occasion of sin, but had luckily also covered the leaf rustling and twig snapping behind me that announced the appearance of Brianna and Massali, Jemmy and Joan swaddled in their arms, and Germaine clinging monkey-like to his mother's back. "I thought they'd never go," Brianna whispered, peering over my shoulder toward the spot where Mr. Lillywhite and his companions had disappeared. "Is the coast clear?" "Yes. Come along." I reached for Germaine, who leaned winningly into my arms.
"Où allons-nous, grand-mère?" he inquired in a sleepy voice, blonde head nuzzling affectionately into my neck.
"Shh! To see grand-père and Father Kenneth," I whispered to him. "We have to be very quiet, though."
"Oh, like this?"
he hissed in a loud whisper, and began to sing a very vulgar French song, chanting half under his breath.
"Shh!"
I clapped a hand across his mouth, moist and sticky with whatever he'd been eating.
"Don't sing, sweetheart. We don't want to wake the babies."
I heard a small stifled noise from Massali, a strangled snort from Bree, and realised that Jamie was still confessing. He appeared to have hit his stride and was now inventing freely, or at least I hope so. He certainly hadn't been doing any of that with me. I poked my head out, looking up and down the trail, but no one was near. I motioned to the girls, and we scuttled across the path and into the darkened tent. Jamie stopped abruptly as we fumbled our way inside. Then I heard him say quickly,
"And sins of anger, pride and jealousy. Ooh, and the odd wee bit of lying as well, Father. Amen."
He dropped to his knees, raced through an act of contrition in French, and was on his feet and taking Germaine from me before Father Kenneth had finished saying the Ego te absolvo. My eyes were becoming adapted to the dark. I could make out the voluminous shapes of the girls and Jamie's tall outline. He stood Germaine on the table before the priest, saying,
"Quickly then, Father, we haven't much time."
"We haven't any water either," the priest observed, "unless you ladies thought to bring any."
He had picked up the flint and tinderbox and was attempting to relight the lamp. Bree and Massali exchanged appalled glances, then shook their heads in unison.
"Dinna fash, Father,"
Jamie spoke soothingly, and I saw him reach out a hand for something on the table. There was a brief squeak of a cork being drawn, and the hot, sweet smell of fine whisky filled the tent as the light caught and grew from the wick, the wavering flame steadying to a small, clear light.
"Under the circumstances," Jamie said, holding out the open flask to the priest.
Father Kenneth's lips pressed together, though I thought with suppressed amusement rather than irritation.
"Under the circumstances, aye," he repeated. "And what should be more appropriate than the water of life, after all?"
He reached up, undid his stock, and pulled up a leather string fastened round his neck, from which dangled a wooden cross and a small glass bottle stoppered with a cork.
"The holy chrism," he explained, undoing the bottle and setting it on the table. "Thank the Virgin Mother that I had it on my person. The sheriff took the box with my mass things."
He made a quick inventory of the objects on the table, counting them off on his fingers.
"Fire, chrism, water, of a sort, and a child. Very well, then. You and your husband will stand as godparents to him, I suppose, ma'am."
This was addressed to me.
Jamie having gone to take up a station by the tent flap. "For all of them, Father," I said, and took a firm grip on Germaine, who seemed disposed to leap off the table. "Hold still, darling, just for a moment." I heard a small whoosh behind me, metal drawn from oiled leather. I glanced back to see Jamie, dim in the shadows, standing guard by the door with his dirk in his hand. A qualm of apprehension curled through my belly, and I heard Bree draw in her breath beside me.
"Jamie, my son," said Father Kenneth in a tone of mild reproval. "Be going on with it, if you please, Father," Jamie replied very calmly. "I mean to have my grandchildren baptized this night, and no one shall prevent it."
The priest drew in his breath with a slight hiss, then shook his head.
"Aye, and if you kill someone, I hope there'll be time for me to shrive you again before they hang us both," he muttered, reaching for the oil. "If there's a choice about it, try for the sheriff, will you, man dear?"
Switching abruptly to Latin, he pushed back Germaine's heavy mop of blonde hair, and his thumb flicked deftly over forehead, lips, and then, diving under the boy's gown in a gesture that made Germaine double up in giggles, heart, in the sign of the cross.
"On behalf of this child, do you renounce Satan and all his works?" he asked,
speaking so fast that I scarcely realised he was speaking English again, and barely caught up in time to join with Jamie in the godparent's response, dutifully reciting, "I do renounce them." I was on edge, keeping an ear out for any noises that might portend the return of Mr. Lillywhite and the sheriff, envisioning just what sort of brouhaha might ensue if they did come back to discover Father Kenneth in the midst of what would surely be considered an illicit ceremonial. I glanced back at Jamie. He was looking at me, and gave me a faint smile that I thought was likely meant for reassurance. If so, it failed utterly. I knew him too well. He wanted his grandchildren baptized, and he would see their souls safely given into God's care if he died for it. Or if we all went to jail, Brianna, Masali, and the children included. Of such stuff are martyrs made, and their families are obliged to lump it.
"Do you believe in one God, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost?"
"Stubborn man," I mouthed at Jamie. His smile widened, and I turned back, hastily chiming in with his firm,
"I do believe."
Was that a footfall on the path outside, or only the evening wind making the tree branches crack as it passed? The questions and responses finished, and the priest grinned at me, looking like a gargoyle in the flickering lamplight. His good eye closed briefly in a wink.
"We'll take it that your answers will be the same for the others, shall we, ma'am?"
"And what will be this sweet lad's baptismal name?" Not breaking his rhythm, the priest took up the whiskey flask and dribbled a careful stream of spirit onto the little boy's head, repeating,
"I baptize thee, Germaine Alexandra Claudel Mackenzie Fraser, in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost. Amen."
Germaine watched this operation with profound interest, round blue eyes crossing as the amber liquid ran down the shallow bridge of his nose and dripped from its stubby tip. He put out a tongue to catch the drops, then made a face at the taste.
"Ick," he said clearly. "Horse piss."
Masali made a brief shot at him, but the priest merely chuckled, swung Germaine off the table, and beckoned to Bree. She held Jimmy over the table, cradled in her arms like a sacrifice. She was intent on the baby's face, but I saw her head twitch slightly, her attention drawn by something outside. There were sounds on the path below. I could hear voices. A group of men, I thought, talking together. Voices genial, but not drunken. I tensed, trying not to look at Jamie. If they came in, I decided, I'd better grab Germaine, scramble under the far edge of the tent, and run for it. I took a preparatory grip on the collar of his gown, just in case. Then I felt a gentle nudge as Bree shifted her weight against me. "It's all right, Mama," she whispered. "It's Roger and Fergus." She nodded toward the dark, then returned her attention to Jimmy. It was, I realised, and the skin of my temples prickled with relief. Now that I knew, I could make out the imperious, slightly nasal sound of Fergus's voice raised in a lengthy oration of some kind. and a low Scottish rumble that I thought must be Roger's. A higher-pitched titter that I recognised as Mr. Goodwin's drifted through the night, followed by some remark in Mr. Lillywhite's aristocratic drawl.